Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Zoe Heller, whose new novel is The Believers, earlier novels, Everything You Know, and What Was She Thinking? Parentheses, Notes on a Scandal. Zoe Heller, Notes on a Scandal became a very well-known film, which was very different from the book. The book was a fascinating character study that was very, very funny, at least to me. The movie was more serious, turning the character of Barbara more into a monster. And there's a monstrous woman also existing in your new book, The Believers, which we'll talk about in a minute. I was doing some research today, and I found out that your dad wrote three screenplays involving monstrous women, one of whom bore a remarkable resemblance to Barbara. The one that did was The Killing of Sister George, and the other two were What Have Happened to Baby Jane and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. There couldn't have been a connection there, could there?
Well, certainly not one that I was conscious of. I think probably it has occurred to me rather late in life that I inherited from my father, my father is dead and has been for a long time, a particular sense of humor, which probably emerges in my books. But I certainly wasn't consciously revisiting the family tradition of writing nasty women.
Well, the character of Barbara and Sister George, I mean, now that you think about it, you can see, particularly in the film, you can see a little bit of a connection.
Yes, I think one of the things about the movie was that they made her very explicitly, straightforwardly lesbian, and she sort of became a lesbian psycho killer towards the end of the movie. I guess those aspects of her character were much less pronounced in the book. I don't think the book ever really came down on the nature of her sexuality. I think she was someone who had a kind of retarded sexuality. I think she was probably interested in anybody who would be interested in her. But in any case, I think the movie was different from the book, and I understood that would be the case, and was sort of reconciled to it. And in some ways, kind of rather delighted by it. It's interesting to see something you have made turned into a quite different artifact.
The amazing thing about the book, What Was She Thinking?, which is why I've recommended it to people, is Barbara's voice, even though she is this rather strange, unappealing woman, her voice is so strong and so fascinating and so funny that we can read between the lines and see what she was thinking,
even though
she's not saying it. And that's an extraordinary achievement.
Well, I'm delighted you say that. Here's the thing, particularly with this latest book, The Believers, I have come across a lot of conversation and criticism about the fact that I write supposedly unlikable characters. The first book I wrote, Everything You Know, was narrated by a very misanthropic middle-aged man. I guess what I would say is, well, two things. One, that I actually don't think my characters are entirely unsympathetic. I love all my characters, and perhaps rather worryingly find aspects of myself in all of them. And one of the things that I think makes all of them somewhat lovable is the fact that they have the capacity to make you laugh. I don't think you can absolutely despise somebody who is so, albeit acerbically, funny. The other thing is I am increasingly irritated by what seems to me a modern phenomenon of people demanding rootable characters. This is the new phrase. People you can root for in books, people you like, people who inspire you and with whom you would like to be friends. I think, there's room for people who are admirable and delightful in books. But the main thing, the main mission of a book is to interest its reader. And that includes writing about any number of unpleasant or difficult people. And indeed, if, and here I become a little bit pompous, but if literature can be said to have any sort of edifying purpose, I think it is precisely that, to be able to generate sympathy and fellow feeling for people who are unlike oneself, who have opinions and ideas and manners that you don't necessarily find delightful.
Well, on top of that, the fun characters to write are those kind of conflicted characters. Always more fun to write a villain than a hero. And on top of that, the fun in writing always is going to come across in the reading.
Absolutely. Yeah, I did absolutely have the most fun writing Audrey, the rather monstrous mother, in The Believers. There's the old saying about happiness writes white, which means it's very difficult to write about happiness, rather easier to write about misery and sadness. And I think the same goes for virtue. Quite a challenge to write a virtuous person in a kind of colourful and entertaining way. But interestingly enough, in this book, I did actually set myself the challenge of trying to write a virtuous person. That character was somebody called Carla, who is the downtrodden daughter of this family. You know, I was doing an online book club with some women who'd got early copies of my book, and they said to a woman, you know, we don't like these characters, they're not very nice. And I said, well, what about Carla? You know, she's actually my heroine. And they said, oh, she's fat and she's a doormat. At which point I had to throw up my hands and say, I can't win. If people are going to be, you know, cast out into the coldness because they're overweight, I don't know what to do anymore.
Well, I mean, she also makes some choices late in the book that are kind of questionable.
She offers the one moment, I think, of real redemption in the novel. She, you know, she finds love. It seems to me that this book has a lot to do with people trying to cope with some of the articles of faith that have supported them and guided them for a long time in their lives, breaking down and ceasing to be credible. I think what Carla does is begin to question the story she has been told and has told herself for many years about who she is and what her role is in life. And I like to think that by the end of it, she has begun successfully to break out of the mold and to allow the real Carla lurking beneath that facade to come out.
The story concerns an attorney, a kind of William Kunstler type attorney, who has a stroke and is in a coma. His wife Audrey is British. The first scene we see, she's very young, and then when she's older, she's a kind of wicked woman who's overbearing on her kids. They're atheist leftists, which kind of relates to your own family. You described your own mother as a Labor Party atheist with Stalinist tendencies in one interview. They have three children. Two are their own, two daughters. Rosa, who's a firm leftist, goes off to Cuba, comes back, and quickly becomes an Orthodox Jew. Carla, the doormat. And Lenny is adopted. And he's got drug issues. Let's talk about the title, The Believers, because I think it really does play a role in this. And to me, the title informs the reader as you're reading the book.
The book is about believers of all sorts. It is primarily about political belief. The family, as you pointed out, are all to varying degrees leftists. The mother and father have raised their children in a tradition of progressive thought and social activism. But the book is also about religious belief, because one of the characters, I don't think she is immediately seduced by Orthodox Judaism, but she certainly in the course of the book begins to explore Orthodox Judaism. And it's about any number of other kinds of belief, the beliefs you have about the state of your marriage or about who you are and what you're meant to do in life. And I guess one of the things I was interested in suggesting was that political belief is not actually so dissimilar in the way it operates to religious belief. That all kind of systems of belief, all ideologies, tend to come with very elaborate defense systems for fending off any new intelligence that might threaten to contradict the kind of basis of themselves, that are hostile to themselves. You know, that we all, no matter what we believe in, have a tendency to stick our fingers in our ears and say, la, 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 when we hear something from the opposition, from an opposing ideology that threatens us or sounds kind of smart and like it might be right, because we want to kind of shore up the fragments of whatever it is we believe in.
Did you know much about Orthodox Judaism when you began tackling that part of the book?
You know, I knew a certain amount. You know, I know some observant Jews, but no, I certainly did a bit of research about it and spent some time with some modern Orthodox and read an awful lot of books.
As you were working on the book, you always had Audrey. I mean, she seems central.
Mm-hmm.
But the daughters, Rose's transformation, at what point did you realize that this particular character would have that arc that she wound up having? Were you searching around for where she would go and chose?
No, that was also always there from the beginning. I mean, it's a really interesting question how a book develops, because you start out with some sort of a roadmap. And in my experience, if you don't make some quite serious digressions from your original roadmap, it's a bad sign. It means that whatever you're writing is going to be dead on the page. There has to be something kind of organic, and it has to be slightly changing, or changing a lot, under your hands as you work on it. In the case of Rosa and her conversion to Orthodox Judaism, that was there pretty much from the start. For me, Rosa is somebody who has, it's a phrase somebody uses in the book, a gift for conviction. She is somebody who needs in life a theory of everything. And when the god of revolutionary socialism fails for her, it's only a matter of time before she starts searching around for some other theory of everything that will provide a grid, an interpretive grid for understanding the world. And it's Judaism that she happens to find.
You said in an interview that you wanted to see how children cope with their parents' life choices, children with some kind of an intellectual inheritance. And I was thinking that I always find it interesting that when you have leftist parents, their kids wind up leftist. Mm-hmm. When you have someone like Norman Podhoretz, you know, who's a right-winger, his son John is even worse, or William Buckley, the right-winger, his son Chris, who's nowhere near as right-wing as his father, is still a right-winger,
yeah.
Or the Bush family versus the Kennedy family.
No, absolutely, and I'm completely with you on this. There is a line of thought that reverse psychology works in these things, and that if you are a very right-wing parent, your child is going to rebel and become something else. I actually think, to an amazing degree, people end up replicating their parents' politics and values. Now, I realize, as I say this, I've written a book which actually suggests the opposite. In the case of Rosa, here's a daughter of leftists who ends up becoming a very religious Jew. I guess what I'm saying is what she gets from her parents is this gift for conviction. And because, as it happens, you know, having spent a large part of her adult life as a very committed revolutionary socialist, when that fails, she has to find something else. But the thing she finds is, at least not in content, but at least in sort of form, not so dissimilar to what she has left behind.
That ties in with, I think in somewhere else you talked about what happened when the leftist believers of the 30s were suddenly confronted with Stalinism. Many of them immediately became staunch right-wingers. It was like, you know, this flick of a switch. The mm-hmm. people who were staunch right-wingers at 14 and then became staunch leftists, it's like they could make that switch without a break.
Yes. There's that fantastic book, The God That Failed, which is a series of essays written by people like Arthur Koestler and Stephen Spender, people who were committed communists and fellow travelers in the 30s. And it's writing about the agonizing process of disillusionment with something to which they had plighted their troth and invested everything, invested their identities in, how they went about slowly disentangling themselves from communism to which they had committed themselves, is a very kind of moving story in a way. And yes, some of them went on to become staunch anti-leftists and sort of Cold War warriors. The others continued to be leftists of a more skeptical stripe, I guess.
Apparently, you started thinking about this because you heard about a gene that made people skeptical. Is that what happened?
No. I read an article in something like Newsweek or Time, an article about scientists who were trying to locate the belief gene. It's actually the opposite of what you're saying. They were looking for a gene that would predispose a person to faith. And the idea was that if you had this gene, you would be inclined to be a believer, and circumstance, environment would dictate the particular nature of the belief, whether it was communism or Catholicism or whatever. And my feeling was that whether or not such a gene existed, it was a wonderful metaphor for something I have observed in life, which is that some of my most fervently believing friends and acquaintances appear to have a different kind of hot wiring. They seem to be made differently from someone like me. I don't have a great talent for belief, and I'm kind of skeptical, temperamentally and otherwise. So I was interested in the idea that there were some people with, as I say, this gift for conviction, how they grapple with their beliefs, particularly when they begin to see sort of fissures forming in the kind of edifice of what they believe in.
Did you have any problem writing a satire of leftist political correctness in the tail end of the age of Bush?
I have to say, I don't see this as a satire on the left. I don't actually see it as a satire. It certainly has some satirical elements in it, this book. I consider myself as a person of the left. I guess I wrote about the left because they are the particular group with which I'm familiar. It seems to me you could write this book about a right-wing community. You could write a wonderful book about, you know, Alan Greenspan and his mates facing up to the fact that the great god of the market has failed them. My feeling is that as a leftist, I'm not on a bound to claim that all leftists are everywhere and at all times lovely people. I also think there are forms of leftist thinking that have been discredited over the years, and certainly leftist theories that people have had problems with. I'm not interested in discrediting or celebrating the left at all. What I'm really interested in is how belief in all its manifestations operates on its adherents.
The character of Audrey, who pretty much takes center stage, and you said before that you enjoyed writing her, it sounds as if, just like with Barbara, her voice was always there in your head, and it was always clear to know how she would respond to everything. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. When I was talking earlier about the way a book has to kind of continue to be growing and stay sort of an organic thing, I don't think I set out thinking that Audrey would be quite so central and prominent throughout the book. But certain characters do kind of elbow their way forward, and she did. She sort of took over things a bit. In fact, the same thing happened with the previous book. Once I had hit upon the idea of having this rather difficult, possibly slightly nuts, teacher narrating the story, it ended up being a story largely about her. You know, I always feel a little, I don't know, insecure, because when I talk to authors who say, my characters all come alive and they come and they sit on the edge of my computer and they tell me what's going to happen and I'm really taking dictation from them, I think, ooh, my characters don't do that. What's wrong with my characters? But then I read a wonderful thing. Nabokov had been told that E.M. Forster said this about his characters, and Nabokov said, oh, really? Well, my characters are galley slaves. They do exactly what I tell them to do. I guess I'm somewhere in the middle between those two extremes. My characters aren't dancing around my desk and explaining what's going to happen next, nor are they quite galley slaves.
Zoe Heller, in writing about Americans, obviously it's a little bit easier with Audrey because she comes from Britain. You're from Britain. You live in the United States. In writing a book where the POV, point of view characters, are American, did that present any kind of problem to you, or do you think you've been in the U.S. long enough to not worry about that?
No, it's an enormous problem for me. I felt fairly confident about American idiom and being able to imitate it, but it is not clear to me anymore whether to say curb or pavement. Both of them seem equally natural, equally affected. I mean, if I say to my daughter, give me a tomato, I feel as if perhaps I'm clinging on rather desperately to this ancient Englishness. I'm still trying to preserve some sort of cut glass expatriate language. And if I say tomato, I feel ludicrous and also like I'm sort of playing a part. I did obviously have, you know, my husband and others sort of screen the novel for moments where I might have slipped into Englishisms. Just as I remember when I wrote my first novel and it was written from the point of view of a man, I remember my husband coming in from the living room saying, sweetie, a man would never describe himself as having screamed.
Your husband is the screenwriter for Star Trek VI, Planet of the Apes. He worked on The Sopranos.
Yes, he did.
Was he a staff writer for them?
Yes.
How was that working for you, him heading over to Jersey and working on it, doing research? Was that any different in terms of, say, just writing screenplays?
It's much more fun for a writer, I think. I don't know, I think it's a better gig, actually, for writers these days working for TV. They tend to be much more powerful, and it's much more of a genuine collaboration. listen, I mean, I'm talking about something I don't really know. I'm talking as the spouse of somebody. It's not my business. I mean, my professional business. He wasn't off in Jersey doing lots of research. He was off at the Silver Cup Studios, I think, you know, when they were actually having story meetings. But, you know, writing is writing. It all comes down to just sitting in a little room and doing your thing.
Do you think that living with a screenwriter helps you in terms of creating realistic dialogue? I mean, when he vets it?
No. Sorry, that sounds incredibly arrogant. The wonderful thing is that I live with a writer, but he's a writer in a completely different form, so we don't really step on each other's toes. I think actually if I have a strength as a writer, it's in dialogue, and it's the thing I find easiest to do. What I find very challenging is the sort of architecture of novels and the structure, which in theory a screenwriter should be very helpful with, but I think probably film structure is sufficiently different to not make it that helpful, because it's, you know, first, second, third act. I don't know, movies just work in different ways.
It's interesting because I've talked to people who will say the reverse, that having worked as screenwriters, it changes their writing in that they get a sense of when to cut. You get an instinctive sense on when to push a scene on. And one friend of mine said that in a sense, a novel is a movie in your mind.
Oh, I hate that idea. Well, I say this, I suppose, a little bit protectively. The principal pleasure I get in writing them, and indeed in reading them, is a beautiful sentence and the rhythm of a sentence. You know, people have asked me, well, now that you know this next book is going to be turned into a movie, will you be writing your novels with the movie in mind? I can't think of anything worse for novel writing than writing with the movie version in mind. I think I'm probably sensitive on this because as somebody who's had a book turned into a movie, I can't tell you how many times I've encountered people who say, haven't read the book, but, you know, saw the movie. It was great. And, of course, the irony for me is I didn't really have anything to do with the movie. I didn't write it. I wasn't on set. It's as if having a book turned into a movie is the ultimate imprimatur on a book. You know, oh, yeah, you were doing some writing, right? You did some writing. You know, you go in a room somewhere and that's nice. It's like I'm arranging flowers. But once it gets turned into a movie, then that must mean you're something serious. You must be a good writer. I think it's the sort of cultural supremacy of movies in our society, which I feel a bit sad about.
Do you think it also might have something to do with a little defensiveness on your part because your husband, your brother, and your dad were screenwriters?
On the contrary, I recognize their fantastic skill as screenwriters and how little I understand or know about film language. I would just like to preserve and respect the difference between the two things.
One big difference for you is that you came out of writing a column for the Telegraph and the Sunday Times. For one thing, you had deadlines, mm-hmm. and even afterward you wrote. So there was a sense of always having to deal with prose, so that when you moved over to novel writing, okay, you're working in a fictional venue, but you're still dealing with prose. You've had all of that under your belt.
Yeah, no, I'm very proud of and grateful for my experience as a journalist. I think journalism, rather than screenwriting, or, you know, the fact that I'm related to screenwriters, has probably resulted in my being a pretty succinct writer. I think I'm probably just naturally a writer, that writes quite short, but it's also the case that journalism, not only writing to deadline, but writing for, you know, give me 500 words on X, has been a tremendous training in that respect. I was a columnist for a couple of years, but I was for a long time just a sort of features journalist. The column is something I became known for, and I'm still living down to some extent, because it was a column about being a sort of girl about town, being in New York, and it got published in English newspapers.
It struck me then, the opening sequence where young Audrey is meeting the lawyer at a party, it almost struck me as if that could have been something that in a different form could have popped up in a column.
Yeah, sure. I mean, these columns were very wide-ranging. They were about, you know, being depressed, about, you know, the joys of a jelly donut, about nasty boyfriends, about any range of things. You know, what I figured out early on was I was writing from New York, but they had a guy covering the Washington beat. So it was clear I was meant to be writing something sort of informal and entertaining. You know, I didn't want to write sort of, there was a fascinating cultural festival at the Lincoln Center this week. So I would mainly write, I guess partly out of laziness and desire not to do much research, I would mainly write about whatever I had been doing that week. And as a result, it became quite personal.
Did you start that before or after Sex and the City?
Long before. It's not much of a, not something I would want to boast about, but I think I'm credited as being not the first, then one of the very first women columnists of that sort, those sort of girl about town columnists. In subsequent years, there are an enormous number of them, particularly in England, where there are lots of papers and lots of pages to fill and lots of competition between newspapers. No, when I saw Sex and the City, I thought, oh yeah, I know the genre. I don't think I felt you're stealing my stuff or anything, if that's what you mean, no.
Zoe Heller, class is more of an issue. Well, maybe it should be more of an issue here, but it's more of an issue in Britain than in America. Here you are writing about American class in a way. How conscious were you of class and the different classes in writing a book like The Believers?
I think any person born and raised in England has a very heightened sensitivity to class issues. You know, it's often suggested somehow that race replaces class as the predominant concern in kind of social relations in America. I'm not sure if that's the case, but it's obvious to me that anywhere you go in America, classes and class distinctions are in operation, and they're fascinating. I think one of the things that obscures class is that what you don't have, as you do in England, is this obvious way of detecting class via accent. You know, the old joke about every time an Englishman opens his mouth, he makes an enemy. Because, you know, and I always notice this as soon as I kind of touch down on English soil, in the first conversation I'm having with the guy who's driving me in a cab or, you know, somebody at the airport, there is an automatic communication of where we both are on the social scale. So it's very apparent and it's out there and it's something that's always audible in England, but, you know, it goes without saying that it exists and is in operation in America at all times.
Zoe Heller, this comment you made, I think it was in this article that was in the New York Times, you said that most readers are women. Most readers of hardback, reasonably literary fiction are women.
Yes, I think both in England and America, all the statistics suggest that the people buying kind of mid-list and literary fiction are women. I would it were different, and thank God, though, that there are women continuing to buy books. You know, I think book reading ain't what it was. I was having a rather mournful conversation with the man who drove me over here today. I'm sure you have heard Philip Roth talking gloomily on the same subject. The audience for literature is dwindling all the time. Of the residual group that are still reading on a regular basis, who have somehow the intellectual energy and powers of concentration for literature, women seem to be the predominant group.
How do your relatives, particularly your brother and your husband, how do they think in terms, do they read a lot, books, novels?
My husband does, I think. I mean, I haven't talked to my brother about this lately. I don't think he's a great fan of the novel.
How does that make you feel, knowing that these screenwriters, your brother, for instance, are not that big fans of the novel? Does it bother you at all, or do you just see it as taste?
Forget screenwriters. I mean, you know, in life, most of the people you meet aren't great readers. I mean, you know, you have to recognize if you're a novelist that you're speaking now to a minority audience.
Zoe Heller, you've now tackled the idea of writing from a third-person perspective.
Yahoo!
With multiple characters, how did that feel compared to writing, what was she thinking, your first novel?
Bloody difficult. Extremely difficult. It was a real challenge. I had written, as you say, my first two books were written in the first person, and I felt in some slightly childish way that real grown-up people had to master third person, and so that I should too. It was very tough for me. I may just be a first-person writer. I hope that I've succeeded with this, but the real challenges for me were being able to juggle multiple points of view, knowing when to change from one point of view to another, all of that stuff. So it was just, I found it a much more complicated endeavor.
And how do you feel about it afterward?
Probably it's too soon to tell how I really feel. At this point in my fairly short career, I've written 3 books now, I have come to feel that one oughtn't to believe the reviewers when they're saying, this is rubbish, and one ought to be equally skeptical when they're saying, this is genius, and that you have to listen to some internal voice that sort of represents your own standard. However, it may take a while for that internal voice to speak. You need a bit of distance from it.
Now that you say that and you bring up reviewers, do you think a writer should bother reading reviews? I mean, other than thinking in terms of commercial popularity, I mean, do you think that it's a drawback to read reviews?
I am, as you Americans say, conflicted about this. I have some novelist friends. My friend Will Self does not read reviews. I think occasionally he will have somebody like his wife screen them and tell him roughly what they're saying. You know, it's for me, it's not even a question of whether it's good or bad. I simply could not resist the temptation. There is no way, if you're sitting, you know, a couple of feet away from me with a newspaper, and in it there is 500 words about something I have spent a couple of years and, you know, expended a lot of blood, sweat, and tears creating, of course I'm going to read it. I mean, what am I, crazy? Of course I'm going to read it. As I say, I think the important thing is to try not to be too cast down by the negative or too exultant about the positive. I just could never not. I would have to read everything.
Zoe Heller, getting back to what we were talking about with first person and third person, your next novel, I assume you've already started working on it.
That's making me feel very guilty. You know, here's the thing. These days, in order to sell a book, you've got to do a lot of going out on the road. I've been out on the road in England for the hardback. I'm doing the same thing here now in America. I will go back to England in a couple of months for the paperback, and then I'll do the same thing for the paperback here. Then, of course, one hopes to sell it to some foreign countries, so you go and do, you know, publicity things for that. It takes quite a while before you have a nice, quiet chunk of time where you're not buzzing off and doing that kind of stuff. I'm at the stage with the next novel where I'm writing notes, and it's sitting in my head. I have not yet actually sat down at the computer and started writing chapter one. And I have to tell you, this is my favorite stage in writing a novel. Well, apart from when you finished it, because it's all there. It seems like a masterpiece right now, because I have yet to confront the limitations of my talent when I actually try and, you know, transpose it. So I know what I would like to write about, and I have a kind of idea of the structure.
Is it first person, third person? Or
it's
do you know?
It's third person, but with a lot less characters. So it's really working through the consciousness of one character. I have to tell you, though, this is early days. In each of my books to date, I have had a kind of protracted period of somewhere anywhere between 3 and 6 months where I've been playing with how I'm going to tell it, and it moves back and forth.
Do you have any interest in getting back into journalism a bit?
I still do journalism. I still write the odd long review. I don't have much interest in doing sort of serious reported features anymore, because I figure, you know, they're quite time consuming and I'm not a quick writer. So if I'm going to spend time writing, I'd really rather be putting it into a novel.
You've been listening to an interview with Zoe Heller, whose latest novel is The Believers. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.